Are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's Journal Club webinar. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB and glad to have you with us for our presentation today. Journal Club 8 in the series, we'll have two more here yet still in the spring semester. So as we get started, if you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, the slides have been made available to you as a handout. So if you'd like to download that, you can follow along with notes in the presentation. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. So please type those in the question block and we will moderate those to our presenter today. When I close out the session, there'll be a short survey. We appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for the fall Journal Club series. And then watch for your email follow-up on Wednesday of this week. That'll include a link to the recording that we're making, the slide handout, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance today. Returning today as our moderator is Virginia Quick. She's Assistant Research Professor at Rutgers University.
Great. Thank you, Rachel. And we're so excited today to have Dr. Abby Gold with us to present. She actually is a vice chair and associate professor in the Department of Public Health at North Dakota State University. She has her doctorate in health communication from North Dakota State University, a master's of public health nutrition from the University of Minnesota, and a bachelor of science in human nutrition from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And Dr. Gold's research focuses on the public health, nutrition, and communication, and she has a strong interest in the intersection between health and agriculture from a social science perspective. Formerly, Dr. Gold was an extension specialist in nutrition and wellness for the University of Minnesota Extension and also for North Dakota State University Extension Service. So it's a pleasure to be able to have her here today to talk to us about socio-ecological approach to exploring rural food access and active living for families with preschoolers. So without further ado, I will let her take it away from here.
All right. Thank you, Ginger. This was really a great honor for me to be invited to present our community's Preventing Childhood Obesity research to members of SNEB. So thank you very much. In order to kind of lay out the groundwork for what I'll be talking about today, first I want to talk about the ecological model of predictors of childhood overweight, which many of you are probably familiar with, and then describe more in detail about how the community portion of the ecological model affects the barriers and facilitators for accessing healthy food and physical activity opportunities in rural preschool children. And while I kind of meet that objective, I really want to talk about our project, Communities Preventing Childhood Obesity, which is has just finished up actually. We were in our sixth year of the project, and in March we finalized all of our details. So finally, I want to talk about the mixed method approach that we used with some of our pre-survey work to try to understand the experiences of rural parents and their preschool age children as they access healthy environments. So here we go. A little bit about the Communities Preventing Childhood Obesity Project. And I'll talk in more in detail about the actual research that and how that was set up and further on down the road here. But this project was a multi-state, seven-state project, and you see the seven states listed there. We had a multidisciplinary team of researchers and extension specialists, and we were funded in that first round of USDA AFRI childhood obesity prevention projects that focused on preschool children. So that was, seems like ages ago, but here we are 6 years later, and we have some nice findings from our project. And the goal of our project was really to look at a community development intervention to prevent childhood obesity in rural areas. So what was really innovative about our project first was that we were a 7-state collaboration, and we had a lot of work that we had to do to sort of get our processes in order and figure out how to work together at a distance. 7 states collaborating can be burdensome, but it can also add to a lot of great learning. We also were looking at community capacity in terms of developing a coalition to work on healthy environments. And we used a community coaching approach and tested that approach out. Our foundation, our theoretical foundation for the project, really was the ecological model of childhood overweight, focusing in on rural communities, low-income families, and preschool-age children. So here's the ecological model of childhood overweight. It's kind of a busy slide that you see here, but really you just see all of the different influences on a child's weight status. And so the best approach is to really take a community-wide look at what's happening within people's spheres of influence so that they can get at the core of what's creating poor dietary intake, leading to sedentary behaviors and lack of physical activity. So we really chose to focus in at the outer ring and to test that outer ring and take that mile high approach in our research, which has its challenges, but also we learned a lot from, really trying to determine what the best measures were at this mile high level. So if we just look at the outer ring of the social ecological model, we see that communities play an important role in the health of their children and their families in many, many ways. So if we first take the local environment, this includes several factors that affect a child's weight status, like access to playgrounds, access to community physical activity facilities, healthy food access. And this is where we really tried to look at in this current study that was published as a research brief that I'm reporting on today. So in the local environment, like I said, the community really is more complex and the relationship to obesity is less understood. However, we have to really try to understand how the community plays a part when implementing an intervention. And so looking at the local environment, like I said, we have neighborhood safety, we have availability of food, convenience foods, we have accessibility to recreational facilities and different types of restaurants. For the school environment, preschool environment, we are looking at lunch programs and physical education activities, or programs rather. Whoops, I got ahead of myself. And then back to the ecological model, when we're looking at population-based characteristics, we're looking at race, socioeconomic status, and ethnicity. And right now, you're probably thinking about the many things that a community can do to improve eating, physical activity, and sedentary levels of children and their families. And what we tried to do with the communities was really provide evidence-based programs that would help address the outer ring and the inner rings of the community. And what we were finding was it was very difficult actually to offer evidence-based programs that were at the outer ring because there isn't a lot of research that shows the impact and the effectiveness of programs that address policy systems and environment. So what a lot of the communities had to do was kind of start at the inner ring and build out. And so this is where the role of a coalition comes into play in helping communities decide what the next steps are. And so community coalitions consist of public and private sector organizations that work with citizens to achieve a shared goal through the coordinated use of resources, leadership, and action. And really the coalitions are vehicles for pushing change through at a community level, and thereby creating a sense of community around the issues of obesity prevention and healthy lifestyles, and also engaging residents in the cause. So for our project, we really felt it was necessary to work at this at this level with the coalitions in order to push some of these community actions forward. In order for a coalition to be successful and build community capacity to support change, a coalition must first be effective in building the coalition's capacity. If the coalition cannot be effective in achieving long-term goals, then that coalition itself cannot survive. And so what we really tried to do was impact the success of a coalition. And there are many barriers to coalition success. And so in our community coaching model, we really tried to look at what some of those barriers are head on and address them with the community coaching model. So when you have a lack of common vision, you see disagreement among coalition members about purpose and goals. When you have a lack of formalization, such as bylaws or processes for how to meet, this can influence the common vision to the degree in which rules, roles, and procedures are defined. So persistent implementation of the operation, such as mission, statement, goals, and objectives, policies, and procedures, are clearly defined roles of the individuals in the coalition. And these are all things that kind of are pitfalls for coalitions. And so I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with the field guide to community coaching, but what this guide tries to do is lay out the process for how a community coach can work with a coalition to build success. So community coaching is probably an effective approach to support community development for sustained community change. And I say probably because the evidence before our project really wasn't built to say that this is indeed an effective approach, especially around childhood obesity prevention or healthy lifestyle, healthy environments coalitions. So what we really sought out to do was test this notion that community coaching is an effective approach, okay? So keep in mind that anytime you measure communities at that policy systems and environment level, there's going to be a lot of, I don't want to say, it's sort of fraught with difficulty. So it was challenging to measure the community as a whole. But let me talk a little bit about community coaching. A community coach is a guide who supports communities and organizations in identifying and achieving their goals. So the community coach is more of a process coach, and they work with the group or the coalition individuals, specifically with the leaders, to help them develop good practices around meetings and pushing efforts forward in a way that creates momentum. So, for example, in my state in North Dakota, I would coach our coach, and when she would go into the communities, and they would have an idea to do something very specific, like that was maybe more individually focused on trying to change the kids themselves, or maybe the teachers in the preschool, in the child care centers. And I would say to the coach, okay, so they're going to do that thing that impacts that just that individual child or a bunch of children, and then what? And then keep asking that question, and then what, and then what, and then what? And eventually you get to, oh, we need to change the way we do things here, or we need to change the policy about how we do something. We need to change the practice so we can influence more people all at once. So the community coach is really there to ask questions of the coalition members so that they don't get stuck on one idea, and they can keep pushing their ideas forward, if that makes sense. And so this chart just really goes through the community intervention approach that we took. It was more of a self-help approach, not a technical assistance approach. So when you take the self-help approach, you are really trying to, push people forward in terms of being able to make decisions for themselves, and push people forward in terms of increasing their capacity to take collective action. And then also problem solving solution is more around identifying solutions and then addressing those solutions by citizens. So it's much more grassroots. And agenda setting happens through deliberation. And then citizens, of course, are in charge rather than scientists or experts or, maybe the mayor or other decision makers. So it's really a citizen-driven process. So just a little bit now about the research, so you understand how we tested our intervention, our community coaching intervention. So remember I said we had 7 states, and each state had 2 communities, so we had a total of 14 communities. Each state had 1 intervention community and 1 control community. The communities in each state were comparable in size and demographics. So, for example, in North Dakota, we're very rural and very frontier. So, we had to match up our communities. But for in Ohio or in Wisconsin, where those states are more populated, their rural areas were larger, or more populated towns in those rural areas. And so those states had to match up their communities. So it was a state-by-state matchup. The communities had to apply for the program, and they had to exhibit some kind of community readiness. And they also had to have an existing community coalition in place. That's not to say that the coalitions didn't have to do a little bit of altering to kind of fit in with the goals of our program, which was to prevent preschool childhood obesity. But all of the communities did have existing coalitions. So what we asked the communities to do, and we gave every community $5,000 a year for 4 years, so both intervention and control, because we wanted to even out the resources available to them. We provided the communities with an assessment of their demographics and of various aspects of their community that they could use to move forward. They also received a menu of evidence-based interventions, which I spoke about a little bit before, and I did delineate that it was really hard to find interventions at that outer ring. At least this was, you know, 5 years ago. So a lot of things have changed since then, which is great. And then the communities were to implement one physical activity and one nutrition intervention. And then the intervention communities, what they did, what set them apart from the control communities, was they hired a community coach to work with their coalition, and that coach received regular training from our experts at Kansas State University. So that was the difference. That was the only difference in the communities, was that coach. So how did we measure impact? And this was took us a lot of deliberation and a lot of searching into the literature to find measures that really looked at that mile high community level. And so what we settled on were three main measures that I list here. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with the Community Healthy Living Index assessments through the YMCA. And I believe there are five or six assessments within that index, and we chose three of them to use. So, and then we also chose a survey called Active Wear, which is a parent survey. And this is what I'm going to talk about in more detail today, because the research brief from our article actually focuses in on this survey. And then the final survey that we used was with the coalition itself, and that was something called the Coalition Self-Assessment Survey. We also added in a ripple effect mapping, which I don't know if any of you have had the opportunity to be a part of that process, but the ripple effect was something we did at the very end of the project with the coalitions as a qualitative measure. So let's focus in on the Active Wear Parent Survey. What we did with this survey was we had a pre-test and we had a post-test. And what this survey does is it assesses community and community factors, and we also had a demographic survey. It also assesses parenting and family characteristics. So it considers the home, the neighborhood, parks and school environments, all related to physical activity and eating. And we focused on low-income parents of preschool-aged children in the 14 communities where we were working. So I'll go back for a sec here. I do want to say that for this project that we reported on in the research brief, at the time we only had the pre-test, and this was published in 2015. We now have the post-test, and we're using it as one of our main measures to complete the picture of what was happening in those communities. We did not survey the same parents pre and post. That would not have been possible because children aged out of the project. And so it was a convenient sample of parents who were whose children attended Head Start or other preschool activities, or so it was a convenient sample of those parents. So for the research brief for this titled A Socially Ecological Approach to Exploring Rural Food Access and Active Living, we used a mixed method approach because we wanted to really understand what parents were saying in the survey, and then looking at their what they reported in the survey in a deeper way through qualitative interviews. And so that way we could go back and forth between the two measures or the two methodologies to gain a deeper understanding of what was happening in those communities. The Active Wear survey, we took all of the surveys from all 14 communities, and that was 377 parents who answered the survey, which has 11 sections. It's actually a rather large survey. And the three sections that we actually included in this sub-study with the interviews were recreation places and sports facilities where your children play, where your child plays, the barriers to activity in the local neighborhood, and then also it had a brief food frequency, and you see the alphas there were quite high. Also, we did one-on-one semi-structured interviews with 15 parents just in North Dakota. When we were talking about, well, who should we interview for this project, first of all, we were in North Dakota, so we're going to stick with our state. But we wanted to get similar communities. We did not go into the communities from CPCO because we didn't want to quote unquote contaminate. And my colleagues in the other states were very clear that if we were to do this sub study, that we couldn't go back to our communities. So we interviewed 15 parents. And this is their characteristics of the parents for the survey and for the participants. So most of the parents had a high school GED or some college, and quite a few of them also had a college degree. And most of them were married. So let's talk about the results of the activewear survey and the pre-survey for the whole project. So physical activity of children was determined by proximity to parks. Playing outside was determined by proximity to the road, and remember, we're looking at safety and we're looking at proximity as sort of a proxy for accessibility to places to be physically active. In terms of food, and this is actually bearing out in the literature regarding rural areas, we did find no significant relationship between the ease of walking to stores and how often fresh fruit or vegetables were available in the home. And you'll see in the interviews where people really talked about accessibility to stores in a different way, which I'll highlight. So for the results of the interview, we had three themes. We had accessibility and utilization of resources. We had neighborhood safety and interpersonal relationships. And I will talk about each one of those themes now. So the accessibility and utilization of resources. This theme categorized barriers to accessing food and physical activity opportunities. So what was really important for these parents was the convenience of accessing resources, and then the knowledge of those resources and the perceived value. All of those things influence how parents utilized the resources available for them. For food, parents had access to a local grocery store, but not everyone chose to shop there. Participants preferred shopping in urban communities to receive the best value. And one of the parents said, "Some nights after work, you stop at the local store and you get food, but it's rotten. And by the time you get home or a day or two later, it's mushy." So I think living in a rural community, people probably do give up a quality fruits and vegetables. It's convenience. It's just that you pay for the convenience and you pay as far as losing quality. We also heard that a lot of the parents say, well, we really want to support our local grocery store, but the quality of the food is so poor that we don't feel like we can. So that was a overarching kind of theme that came out of these interviews for this population. Of course, in our area, North Dakota, for physical activity, seasonality influenced patterns and utilization of indoor and outdoor recreational spaces. Recreational programs were available for preschoolers in the summer, though. In the winter, children engaged in indoor activities, but limited space restricted their ability to stay active. For neighborhood safety, and this is sort of different in rural areas than obviously it's different in rural areas for than urban areas. Here we're looking at more access to safe places to be active in terms of, you know, safety from the road and busy traffic and highways. And parents believe their local neighborhood was generally safe for their preschoolers, but there were several threats to safety that were mentioned, including the need for supervision and enforcement of rules and boundaries for outdoor play. And parents who live near a highway without sidewalks admitted their family would walk or bike more if a trail was available, but sometimes believe their community lacked financial resources to develop those kinds of amenities. And then finally, and this I think actually is the most interesting, something that I would like to look deeper into, is the social connectedness of people in rural areas. And a lot of people say that when you live in a small town, everybody knows everybody else, and sometimes everybody's in everybody else's business. And we also heard, though, that people felt very disconnected, at least in the, you know, the small sample that we had of people that were interviewed. Participants without a strong social, local social network, for instance, those who were new to a community, described difficulty knowing about available programs or recreational facilities. And they really relied on social ties to get needed information about those kinds of resources. Value was placed on developing interpersonal relationships. That was clear among the participants. And participants really expressed the need for more community events or programs to connect them with other families, fostering social development among their children. Enrolling children in early childcare programs was recognized as another method of establishing interpersonal relationships. The other thing that was interesting from a food standpoint was that interpersonal relationships promoted food access. Participants obtained affordable produce through friends' garden surplus. Other food access options included community-supported agriculture programs and food delivery services. So I think this is this interpersonal relationship piece and the networks that are created because of these relationships is an important thing to explore further in rural areas. So for the most part, our conclusions and recommendations really focused in on these three things. First of all, proximity and traffic safety. Promoting active transport like walking and biking is important, but if people don't feel safe, if traffic is too busy and the community doesn't engage in traffic calming techniques, then you're going to have less active transport and less kids riding their bikes or walking in the neighborhoods or walking to places. And the other thing is we're thinking about really creative solutions to public transportation. You know, all we think of rural areas as places that are perhaps wild, are not very, I guess, they don't have a lot of infrastructure, but that's simply not true when you fly over a lot of places and you look down at the farm fields and all of the infrastructure that's in place for farming communities. Those communities are very, very planned out. And so in order to capitalize on some of that individual farming or an individual farmer piece, I think it's important to get people together and build those social networks and help them value that social capital. Furthermore, and a lot of people are working on this when it comes to food, is that assessment of the local consumer and how they would like to set up their food environment, so that when we're working in these community coalitions, we can really start focusing in on what are the particular needs of the rural areas, and bringing people together in these decision-making processes is absolutely necessary in order to help promote policy systems and environment changes in those communities. So that's all I have about our research brief that we are reporting on for this. I hope I stimulated your interest in this whole notion of community coaching, and I want to send you to these excellent new resources that we just they're hot off the press, actually. The first is the CPCO toolkit, which is actually just a PDF version of our project and how to and all of the ins and outs of how to, you know, engage a community in this coaching model. And then if you're more of a somebody who likes to actually listen and go through each thing step by step and do a training, there is also CPCO Learning Module, which is an online learning environment for as a training. So, and that's put out through the Ohio University on their extension website. So I will entertain questions now.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Abigail, for a wonderful presentation. And I'm sure we'll have a number of questions from those listening in. So if you do have a question, make sure to actually type it in the GoToWebinar box. So one of the first questions that we have from a listener is they're wondering how long the parent survey was that they took, and how and if parents were compensated for taking that survey at the for the pretest.
Okay, so yes, they were compensated. It was done through an interview, so so the survey was about 20 pages long, and the one of our usually our extension people in the communities delivered the surveys as in more of an interview style. So it wasn't something that we just handed out to people and had them take it and bring it back to us. And they were given an incentive.
Okay, great. They're also wondering, did you encounter any difficulties during the recruitment of the various communities? I know they had to apply, I guess, to be a part of this research study. But yeah, I was just, you know, curious about that.
We didn't really have any difficulties. Actually, we, you know, because of extension and the relationships that we have in the communities, and many of the coalitions did have extension professionals on them, so we were able to sort of reach out into the relationships that we had already built in the communities and bring them in and ask them to apply.
Okay, great.
I think it also helped. I think it also helped that we were able to provide them with, you know, small $5,000 a year to basically use on anything that they wanted. I mean, they had to tell us what they were going to do within the parameters of the project. But
right, that's great. Also wondering, so they're, you know, you were targeting these rural communities. Did majority of them have their own cars, or do they use public transportation to get around? I was just wondering how, like, the accessibility and availability, you know, to go to a grocery store and this and that might have deterred some, like, healthier eating choices.
Are we talking about the interviews or the interviews?
Interviews or through the survey. I don't know if you asked that question at all.
I'm not sure we did ask the question. But the interviews, I know that many of them, you know, they did have their own cars. It's I mean, where you're dealing with difficulty is the price of gas and traveling long distances. So what we heard the family say when they traveled to the urban centers to pick up food or other things, they were very efficient. They would do many different errands all at once.
Okay, great. Another question. They were wondering, are there any published papers on the toolkit that you mentioned here on the last slide or the learning module?
Yes, so that's something that we just released. So we haven't done any evaluation on the toolkit itself.
Got you.
I mean, the
Okay.
toolkit reflects the work that we did in the communities over
Okay.
4 years, because the intervention was 4 years. So
Okay.
the papers that will be coming out about our final outcomes, and we're in the process of writing those papers right now.
Okay.
And I suppose that will sort of be the evaluation of the toolkit, but we don't have an evaluation of it itself about how people are using the toolkit, if that was.
Yeah, well, I think it would be interesting if anybody else wanted to adopt, the similar approach that you did and take it into their communities, for them to use maybe the same evaluation tools. You can see, how effective it is in other locations. Yeah, I think it would be
And
really.
that is all in the toolkit, like our assessment and how we went about it. And that's a really good idea because, you want replication as much as possible. What we really tried to do in this project is tell a story about what was happening in the communities. And that's why we chose the ripple effect mapping too, which is a whole nother topic.
Yeah, actually, that was going to be my next question. I was like, so what is the ripple effect? But you brought it up, and now I'm curious.
So, ripple effect mapping is like a mind mapping tool that you can do with groups, and you can do it either for as a like a pre or a planning for an event or a project, or you can do it as an after the fact. What hap So basically, if you just think, it's metaphorical. You have, for us, it was okay, the center of time, the beginning of time was when the project came on board and the coalition started working on childhood obesity prevention. What are all the things that happened as a result of this effort? And you draw a map. And then what we did was we categorized all of the things that happened in terms of social, in terms of the community capitals framework and the social ecological model.
Very cool. Okay. Are you planning on publishing any of those findings? Okay, great. You've gone too soon,
it.
Margo.
We're working on it.
Got it. And that kind of brings me to my follow-up question. So you had mentioned the post survey. I'm guessing you recently, collected that information and you're in the process of, analyzing that as well, I imagine.
Yes, and we found some interesting things. I mean, granted, there are some limitations because we're not using the same people from pre to post, and the communities are very different from each other. But basically, what we found was that in all areas, those 11 sections of the survey, the intervention group improved when
That's
compared
great.
to the comparison group. However, the intervention group started lower than the comparison group, and they when they ended they ended at the same point. So nothing, so in the comparison group, nothing, they kind of stayed the same. That's the main gist of our findings from ActiveWare, as it. I probably revealed too much. My colleagues might be like, "Why are you telling me all this?"
Well, you didn't get into specifics, so yeah, we thank you for sharing the information that you have today. Another question we have, they were wondering how you came up with a definition for, the size or the involvement for what you categorize as a coalition. I I guess in Arizona, this one researcher has said that they found it relatively few coalitions in their rural towns. So I don't know if you had like a certain requirement for the size or involvement of the coalition for them to be a part of it.
I can honestly say I don't remember because, you know, it was like 5 years ago. But yes, we did.
Okay.
We did have criteria. And they had, mainly they had to be existing coalitions.
Okay.
And like in North Dakota, we actually did have existing coalitions. I think they were called 5+5 coalitions that dealt with healthy eating. So, so we didn't really have any problems finding groups of people that were engaged in this kind of work across the states.
Okay.
That wasn't
so what would you, so what would you say for, you know, somebody in one of their states and in their rural towns, if they don't have any pre-existing coalitions, what type of strategies would someone take in trying to form one? Is there any resources that can help the individual in forming it?
Yeah. Well, I think that first of all, every coalition needs a champion, and so whether it's the mayor of the town or the superintendent or the director of the preschool or public health leaders in those communities, and a lot of public health agencies now are moving to become, you know, with public health 3.0, chief health strategists. And so this is a perfect activity for the role for public health now to really engage communities in this coalition work. So resources available. Right. Well, unfortunately, there, you know, a lot of times you kind of start these things without any money, and then you realize, oh, we need money to do this and that and other thing. And then the coalition starts engaging in fundraising and grant writing. And I would say a good place to start are the, what are those called? The community, like what we have in Fargo-Moorhead is the Fargo-Moorhead Area Foundation. So area foundations are really great. And every state has them, or counties or communities. They're really great seed money. You might not need very much money to do something like this. In fact, the $5,000 wasn't always easy to spend for some of our coalitions. You have to be very, very creative. It's not a lot of money, but people just don't always, you know, it's not always easy to spend money.
Gotcha. So with this type of, you know, having these coalitions already in place definitely probably helps. But I'm wondering about the sustainability of the coalitions after you, I mentioned, so now that the grant is, you know, over and there's no more funding, moving forward, do you think these, you know, these different coalitions will still be, continue to be active and, I guess, moving forward with whatever initiatives they might have?
Yes, I think that we haven't done any formal exploration of what the coalitions are up to now, but they were, I didn't hear any word from my colleagues that the coalitions were disbanding. I think one of the great things that happened in our communities is that they have this skill now for community coaching, which those people that were a part of that process can now move that forward.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the control communities, though. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we have another question from a listener. I might have to repeat it because it's long. So they were questioning, so you mentioned that people didn't rely on their local stores because the quality of the produce was not very good. They're wondering, do you think if there was an initiative to improve the community stores, that residents might change their habits and shop there more frequently? So similar type corner store interventions have been done in urban areas with success.
Yes, the answer to that is yes, I think that they would. Yeah. But Well, I don't know if you've all heard of the Rural Grocery Store Initiative out of Kansas State University, which has a lot of great resources. And I know that in Minnesota, we're going to have a corner store initiative for rural grocery stores and corner stores. So I think that when you put your efforts into this kind of improvement in your community, you can see great results. But I do think, especially in rural areas, that it needs to be community driven so that everybody's on board with what's happening and they're utilizing that resource, and the shop owners think it's worthwhile and they can make money off of, what they're selling. So, yes, I do think it's possible, but it needs to be a community effort.
Yeah, I mean, case in point, there has to be community buy-in, really, from what it sounds like. So, great. So, I'm sure you learned a lot through this experience, and building these coalitions or assisting them in forming some of these health initiatives. I don't know if you would have any, lessons learned from your experiences doing this project that you want to share with anybody else who maybe wants to adopt something very similar in their communities.
Yeah, there are a lot of lessons learned, but I think the biggest one was that we set out to we had a very kind of rigid, because this was a grant that we proposed to USDA, and we had kind of a rigid framework, and which included having the communities engage in one nutrition and one physical activity project every year, and that project would be evidence-based. Well, yeah, that didn't really pan out because, first of all, not everything is evidence-based. So, for example, one of our communities in Wisconsin, they wanted to do a snowshoe activity or have like build snowshoe paths for the community. That's not like, do you have research on how great snowshoe paths are for, probably not, but I'll probably get a lot of good use out of an amenity like that in your community. And, so I think I wouldn't be so rigid the next time around.
Great. Well, thank you. So we have, I guess, one more question. They're wondering, do you recall where you got the data about proximity to parks in rural areas? I guess they've only seen data for urban areas, but not rural before.
I would have to open up my paper and see what the reference is for that, but I'm fairly certain that we have a reference in there that does some comparison around access to amenities like parks in rural areas. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that
Well, I'm
right
sure
off
they
the
could
top of
follow up
my
with you with
head.
an email. I'm sure they could just follow up with you with an email if need be. So
Yes,
great.
by all means.
Great. So we don't have any other questions. Is there anything else you want to say before we close out today's presentation?
No, I just want to say thank you to everybody out there and for the great questions. And if you want to know more about CPCO and the toolkit and or more about our project, please get in touch with me.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So we'll let Rachel close out today's webinar.
Yeah, we had one more question come in. This, as you mentioned, a field guide to community coaching. Is that the Emory et al. Reference?
It is.
Okay, awesome.
Yes. I'm sorry I didn't put it up on my slides, but yes, that's the reference. And it's available online as a PDF download, real easy to find.
Excellent. Lots of great new tools today. Thank you very much. Just a reminder to everyone, there'll be a short survey when I close out the webinar, and then we'll do an email follow-up to you on Wednesday of this week with the recording and the slides and your CEU certificate. Journal Club will be back in 2 weeks on 4/27. Neil Edens is doing an experiential cooking and nutrition education program, increasing cooking self-efficacy and vegetable consumption in children grade 3 through 8. So you can register for that one on the website. Also, SNEB webinars this week, we're going to look at the scientific evidence behind the Mediterranean diet. That webinar is on Wednesday. And then you might be interested in the next Hot Topics call, sponsored by the Higher Education Division. That's going to be on 4/19, and it's going to talk about Ascend. So check the website out for those upcoming programs, and we look forward to seeing you back at the next Journal Club.